Welcome back to the Get Cyber Resilient Show. This week is our Behind the News episode. I'm Dan McDermott, your host for today, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity experts, Garrett O'Hara and Vin Yuan. Today, we will review and update the ongoing fallout from the Optus and Medibank breaches, as well as look at the latest victim, Harcourt, in the real estate sector. Next, we'll look into the takedown of an international cyber criminal in the Netherlands. Then, staying in Europe, we'll dive into the German copper smelter attack and the implications for Australia. And as always, we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Gar and Vin, welcome to episode 117. Gar, you and I had the privilege of hosting our first ever in-person Get Cyber Resilient think tank last week with a number of leading cyber professionals from across the country, where we posed the topic of, after the breach, what is Australia's cybersecurity future? And that's where we'll start this week's episode, with an update on the Medibank and Optus breaches and the ongoing implications.
Yeah, Dan, it's clearly the story that's gripped a nation, or stories that have gripped a nation. And it seems like it's starting to settle down, I think, at this point, certainly with Optus. I think it is what it is. We understand the scope and the impact. I think the latest thing on Optus is that, and I think this was only yesterday, they have come out and said that they would pay remediation damages for foreign passports. So I think that's, you know, kind of a new thing there. But Medibank, I think, it's interesting to me that, you know, Medibank happened, and if it took so much of the focus away from Optus, it's almost like, very, very lucky for the Optus comms team and the PR team that Medibank happened so quickly afterwards. And obviously, given it was personal health information, I think many people were even more abhorred by the potential impact to them and their lives, including people that are close to me. And I'm guessing you guys are in the same boat. You know, you've got your friends saying, hey, I'm part of this. What does it mean for me? I think that's where it starts to feel really personal. I think since we last spoke, obviously, Medibank have come out and sort of called out that it was more than they originally anticipated in the attack. You know, that there was more information compromised. I think it's pretty much all of their customers at this point. Dan, how many times we have this conversation with people around how to put the price on cyber, Vin, you'd be in the same boat. It's one of those things I think security people struggle with all the time. And looking at the numbers, certainly for Medibank, they had a 15% drop in share price, which cost them about $1.8 billion. I think that's a price that maybe we could put on cyber. And likewise for Optus, there's stats coming out saying around 10% of customers have walked out the door. That's the price of cyber. It's such a difficult one to navigate so often, and again, we've had this conversation so many times around how do you build metrics? How do you, create the dollar values to sort of show the value of cybersecurity or risk? And this is it, here we go. Like the boards, exco's around Australia, probably around the world, are looking at this stuff and hopefully starting to see some dollar signs in their minds. There was a bit of a debate that kind of hit the news as well around should Medibank pay the ransom, with the AFP kind of warning them off that, which I think is the right move. As bad as it is, I think it's not a good move to pay the ransom. So that was a pretty sort of public comment from AFP around not paying. But yeah, look, it seems like such a schmozzle. I think there's probably a sense of massive fatigue hitting Australians and maybe a sense of apprehension about what's next. You know, that's the thing. And I know we're going to talk about Harcourts, I think, in a moment. But I think this is the penny drop moment for Australians around how much of their data is sitting in places that are not secure.
And Vin, as well as, the pay or not to pay. The other part as well is with cyber insurance, with Medibank sort of coming out that cyber insurance wasn't going to cover them either. So they feel a bit stuck, right, in terms of what's their next steps and remediation from here?
Yeah, and it's not going to be just Medibank either. I think a lot of organizations are feeling the pinch when it comes to things like cyber insurance, how the premiums are going up, and then there's that conversation around is this something that we want to kind of proceed with? Is something that we kind of hold off on? And I guess Medibank being a story where not having the insurance obviously didn't work out in that particular case. But from kind of our perspective, in terms of the actual, do you pay, do you not? That's an interesting one, because Well, there's no guarantee, right? I think that's the direction that AFP are going for with ransomware payments. And although this isn't necessarily ransomware, it is still data exfiltration, and they want a price or, you know, funds to be able to kind of give it back and promise not to kind of go ahead with it. So that's my inkling. That's my thing of why it's been warned not to pay. It's because you can give all the money, but also sets up a dangerous precedence, right? That if we're willing to pay for this type of information, what's stopping from other organizations similar, instead of holding similar data, why wouldn't they pay? And again, it just makes that target on back a lot bigger.
And the lack of insurance in this case, the numbers being reported, I don't know how much an insurance premium costs, but yeah, according to some of the articles, it's looking like Medibank is going to have to pay between 25 and 35 million based on them not having cyber insurance. So I don't know, maybe that's just, you know, 1% of a sort of an executive's annual salary. I suspect it's not, but it's not a small amount of money.
As a marketing professional, one of the things that has really caught my attention as part of this is the whole notion of crisis communications in this. And that's what these incidents are, right, from a comms perspective. And we saw early on Optus were, pointed out as to, some of the mistakes and some of the actions that they were taking. Medibank was lauded in the first instance of, they've come out on the front foot, they've shut systems down, they've given information to people. The challenge has been that, as more information has seemed to come to light, they've had to keep recounting sort of where they were at. Oh, no data was stolen. Oh, yes, it was. It was only for these systems. Oh, no, it was more than that. I feel as though, it's one of those really tricky ones where Medibank tried to get on the front foot and that looked good early, but really, were they communicating something that they just didn't have enough information on? And how do you sort of get the telemetry of the data and the information from the cyber teams so that the communications can actually be, meaningful and effective and timely to all stakeholders?
And there's two sides to that, isn't there, Dan? It's the comms teams and, kind of the measured, accurate reporting. And then it's the expectation from the public, I suspect, on being kind of reasonable about what can be communicated and what kind of timelines. And, some of the commentary I've read is that so often the internal teams may not even know what's going on in a way that the media does, because the media is able to get onto sort of the dark web and, the forums, understand exactly what's happened. And they're contacting the PR and PR team saying, is this true? And the PR teams are saying, well, we don't know. We haven't been told. So everything kind of gets flipped on its head. Anthony Caruana was on episode 73. I just looked it up in the background while you were chatting there. And he talks about this exact topic, crisis communications and how, you obviously need to plan this stuff well in advance to know who's going to say what at what time. And what they're not going to say, to your point, I think is incredibly important also. And I think we actually spoke about this, right, when Optus happened, this issue of you want to be honest, you want to sort of communicate, but you can't get ahead of yourself because it's almost worse to have to roll back from what you've said than to not say anything. And, I think that's the key, is waiting for the information, which is incredibly complex to understand. Which, again, I think general public won't really get, the three of us and hopefully our listeners would understand, when an incident happens, trying to understand the impact, what's been touched, what's been stolen, what's been accessed. That is not a simple thing to do, and it takes some time, and it's weirdly not accurate either sometimes. And the thing you think has happened sometimes isn't, hasn't actually happened. And I think that's what you saw is, the kind of getting ahead of yourself can certainly backfire in some instances all too often. Some of the articles have called out the use of the word sophisticated as a go-to for any comms or PR team. And I almost think, as a marketing professional, if you can get the word out there to just don't use that word, it's probably one you want to steer clear of, because so often it turns out, this stuff isn't sophisticated. It's just the basic vulnerabilities that have been around for some time, including humans.
And to that point as well, guys, if you think about the stress the IT teams and the likes of it trying to, figure out what's happening, they still need to focus on making sure that the organization and the daily functions are also still happening and services are up and running as soon as possible. So they've got quite a bit on their hands to actually manage. And you've got to really feel for a lot of these, the teams who are addressing this. And we talked about last time where burnout's a thing, right? And nothing will test burnout more than going through a security incident. It highlights the importance of having a process. And, you know, we talk about tabletop exercises as part of like these practice emergency drills to kind of make sure your processes are up to date and people know what they're doing. There's one thing to do it, but then there's also, I guess now there's a real intent to, hey, we need to really put our best foot forward when we run these tabletop exercises because we don't know when this is going to happen to us. We need to be prepared. And I'm guessing from what Minibank has done, tabletop exercises might be part of their, I guess, regular type of review because, you know, from what my perspective is, I think they've done a pretty good job in terms of kind of giving us the information that the public needed.
You made a point there, Vin, that I had never thought of before, which is the value of the simulations and the practice in stress management. Because I think I've always thought about it in terms of like good outcomes and getting to, you know, resolution of an incident more quickly and, you know, just clarity in what's going to happen. But I'm pretty sure, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but, you know, if you've practiced something over and over again, when the real thing happens and you know your role and you know the plan, yeah, presumably that's going to be less stressful than, you know, it happens and everyone's kind of running around freaking out. You know, they talk about astronauts who train to launch in rockets that they're actually pretty calm when it happens because they've done it so many times. And I think you made actually a really good point there around just stress management. You know, if you've practiced it so often, then when the real thing happens, not that it won't be scary and it won't be awful and the hours won't be incredibly long and your veins won't be full of Red Bull and caffeine and you're just trying to get through, but at least you kind of know what the plan is and you know what your teammates are going to do and what your bit is and what other people's bit is. Like, so apart from good security outcomes, like the, you know, the stress and that sort of mental health thing is probably very important as well.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak on flying a rocket or anything like that, but
what
I used to do, I guess not piano concerts, but recitals. There's a lot of time when I was really scared and worried I was going to mess up. But because I practiced so much, even though my mind drifted a bit, my fingers knew what to do. Like they've done it that many times that they just were on autopilot. And that kind of helped with the stress too. So definitely see, the more you do it, the easier it gets, right?
And it's an interesting one though, right? Because every business is busy. Everyone's got a lot on their plate and it is, and I think it's that challenge of carving out the time to do that practice, right? And do it in a situation that actually feels a bit of stress because otherwise it feels a little bit like the old Mike Tyson saying of, you know, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And then all of a sudden it all goes, you know, pear-shaped pretty quickly. And I feel like that's what happens in these moments. It's like they've thought about it, they've discussed it, and you know, people sort of have an idea, and then wow, once it hits you, it's a very different reality.
Oh, look, I was going to just mention as you're talking about that, Dan, when Nick Abrahams was on, you know, he talked about the simulations that he runs and kind of building the ransomware muscle memory, and that kind of landed with me also because he sort of talked through how you can kind of elicit those emotions with leadership. You know, through kind of realistic scenarios and kind of maybe pose those questions. Okay, here you go. What do you do? And they give an answer and you say, well, you can't do that because that server is not available. And, you know, you can see the penny kind of dropping and how complex and difficult this stuff can be.
And you spoke about the journalism before, actually, as part of Nick's simulations. He's good friends with Chris Reason, the Channel 7 journalist, and he's actually has Chris come in and actually do sort of pre-recorded things of like, you know, Chris Reason calling from Channel 7 News, we've heard you've had a data breach and like, you know, and sort of call it into the business and that. So it makes it makes it very real and it's like, you know, and it escalates throughout the day and it's like, if I don't hear back from you, I'm running with this on the 6 o'clock news, you know, and it's sort of like, so then the journalist is sort of filling in the gaps and telling the story rather than the business, right? And so, I think it's a very, I think, purposeful way of demonstrating like how quickly it intensifies and how then how you have to be able to react given whether you have the information or don't have the information, what you will and won't say, it makes it a very real scenario for people very quickly. The other part that this has really highlighted is data and data storage and how long do you keep things, who has access to it, do we need all of that information? And I think that also has made us all think of other businesses that collect, you know, this type of personal information and what sort of vulnerabilities do they have. And unfortunately, we've now seen, you know, that play out with real estate being one of those obvious examples, particularly in the rental market, right, of them collecting a lot of personal information and having that on store And a lot of them are, you know, small businesses or a franchise of a larger sort of operation. And we've seen Harcourt's been hit, you know, one of the oldest real estate agents around. And all of a sudden, you know, again, that notion of the collection of that private information of citizens is now very vulnerable.
And this one, Dan, I mean, there's so much in, you know, it's a familiar story, unfortunately, but it's got a lot in it. The compromise here, you know, the Harcourt's team sort of said that it was actually based on a account being compromised for a service called Stafflink, which apparently is a property and task management software for real estate. You know, never heard of that before because I'm not in real estate. But there you go. You know, that supply chain thing where you're dependent on different platforms to do the job of being a real estate agent. And you know, what does that all mean? And interesting to see that they came back and, you know, part of what they did was adding multi-factor authentication and changing password policies. And, you know, with no comment or, you know, sort of attempt to cast aspersions, not at all. But, you know, it's the sort of stuff that you think more and more we need organizations to be doing that stuff as a default, you know, not waiting till something happens and then, you know, making those kind of changes. So hopefully that's something that comes from it and is good. I personally find this stuff super scary because I don't know if you guys do the same thing, but you go back over all of the interactions you've had with, you know, realtors, with finance, banks, service providers, energy companies, all the things that I've given out over the years, scans of licenses and passports. And, you know, at some point, it's going to happen, right? For everybody nearly, it feels like, you know, there's so many companies have all of this stuff. Like at what point do you get the phone call or the email?
And I think that's also one of the things that it does seem like there's been a shift in mindset of, you know, of not if, but when this is going to happen. So everybody, I think, in the cyber community is feeling, you know, very sorry, as like you said, Bin, like for the teams that are going through this and nobody wishes it upon anybody. But there's also that reality of feeling like it's probably going to happen to us one day. We're kind of be in this situation. And it's been interesting to therefore see like the government reaction to this has been, well, let's, you know, increase legislation and increase fines. Like, you know, so if you get breached, we're going to put fines in place. But does that actually address the underlying issue of secure personal information and identity verification? Like, will that change anything?
I think it's the right step, right? It's still very early days in terms of, you know, what is next. But the fact that we're now changed the Privacy Act to go from a $2.2 million fine to 50 and potentially more, depending on what type of information kind of gets leaked as a result, this is what's going to light the fire in the bums of the likes of like board members and key stakeholders, where security was generally seen as just something you had to do to kind of get business done. But now looking at the potential fines and consequences of a breach, then it's instead of bolting on security to our process, which is generally what happens, like let's make security part of the foundation when we're rolling out something, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's funny, I was talking to a friend who's in fintech and a developer in that world. And to your point, Finn, he was describing how they have a security person who's been brought in. Obviously, you know, they're doing pretty well. But it was interesting to hear the sort of tension and friction as that security person is now being brought into those secure by design conversations early in the dev cycle. Mm-hmm. And the developers are, you know, happily they're actually very good at what they do. So they're on board. But it's interesting to hear how, yeah, that secure by design, you know, we talk about it all the time as just such an amazing thing, but you know, also there's a little bit of politics and friction that does get introduced as that person is now navigating being in every single meeting for every platform product that they do and asking the hard questions around, hey, like, what are we storing? Why are we storing it? Why do we need to store that? Can we get rid of it? And, you know, the default, actually, I was on a call with a bunch of people this morning, and we were talking about this exact thing where so many organizations actually don't even know what their retention requirements are. And you walk in the room and, you know, you start having a discussion, is it 7 years, 10 years? What do you need to retain? And so often the answer is, yeah, we're not really sure. So we just keep everything forever. And, you know, that is an easy solution, but it's a dangerous one, I would say, because you end up with a ton of data. And the more data you have, the more risk you have. So yeah, interesting.
I think the final point on this one is we've just seen the ACSC release the latest annual report with, you know, again, no surprise, you know, an uptick in cybercrime, ransomware at an all-time high, all of these things happening. And I guess the only silver lining to all of this potentially is the fact that, you know, the access hopefully to boards and executive and budget that is required, that cyber professionals have been asking for years, to put ensure that all of those best practices, the essential eight and all of those requirements are in place as, you know, baseline fundamentals, I think is going to get listened to a lot more, because nobody wants to be in this situation. Nobody wants to be on that front page. And, you know, maybe that is the silver lining, that, you know, it's the opportunity for everybody to get what they need to ensure that their house is in order as best as possible, and then still knowing that, you know, it's not if but when.
And doesn't this all prove that, you know, that whole thing, there's no such thing as bad publicity? Like, cyber has changed that.
I think that's a pretty old adage these days.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks for the recap. And looking through our next story, Vin, we look at an arrest of a cyber criminal in Europe who is running an operation called Raccoon Info Stealer. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, essentially a beware of raccoons. I think they're a big problem here in Australia. But in terms of the Raccoon Info Stealer, this was a fairly young 26-year-old. And I'm going to read the name in case I do mispronounce it. Mark Sokolovsky, currently being held in the Netherlands. And the United States are looking for extradition based off him being what has been noted down as being the core developer around this piece of malware, which essentially will get into your system and then look at stealing information like potentially login credentials, like financial information, like credit cards. And the key thing here is he's commoditized it. And we're seeing this quite a lot with a lot of the, I guess, services out there, like phishing as a service, ransomware as a service, where for a set amount of money, in this case, around $300 a month, you pay him or his group through cryptocurrency, and then you have access to his Raccoon Info Stealer. What's really interesting about this one is when you then start to look at, you think of, well, you know, before I started cybersecurity, I was watching a lot of Mr. Robot, and all I thought was just codes running down the screen, and it's all going to be really complex to hack. You look at the GUI for this actual Raccoon software, it's very clean. It looks very easy to use. There's filters, there's support on hand as well. It just kind of shows the level of entry or the barrier of entry for hacking is so easy for most people. Like a 26-year-old being able to kind of build this and share it across, you know, a whole bunch of people, resulting in over 50 million different PII instances of email addresses, credit card numbers, taken from millions of alleged victims. That's absolutely huge for something that costs $300 a month to lease out.
There's some awesome stuff on Brian Krebs, who, you know, pretty much everyone knows who that is, has an awesome write-up on the background and the story of this. And it's so funny, like, as they sort of found this guy through, you know, he I suppose, messed up in his SecOps. And when he originally posted on the kind of crime forums, he used a Gmail address that was trackable back to his Apple address and iCloud. But they've got selfies of him with, you know, almost gangster style, you know, with the wads of money, like, you know, that stuff. And they've got photos of him. And this is kind of bonkers, but he's Ukrainian. And fled the country when the kind of military, you know, when they sort of call everybody into the military. I think anyone who's over the age of 18 was kind of up for service, given what's going on with Russia. But he made his way out of Ukraine, and there's a photo of him in a Porsche Cayenne. And this is all on Brian Krebs' website, you know, passing into the Polish border, passing through the Polish border. And then they were able to track where he was doing and what he was doing. Through he was kind of accompanied by what I assume is his girlfriend, but she was posting photos on Instagram of the different places they were going, including, like, there's this photo of them as they arrive into the Netherlands, you know, clearly a happy couple arriving, not realizing that, you know, there's sort of EXIF data in those photos that's trackable, and obviously that's how the police in the Netherlands were able to catch up with them. But obviously pretty hectic stuff, but interesting to see how they were able to, or potentially how they were able to kind of catch this guy.
It kind of combines two of my favorite things, which is cybersecurity and like peak millennial things. Like, imagine being able to be caught out based off Instagram posts. Like that, you couldn't write any better, right?
Sounds like could be a movie in that one. I think that it's going to, one of these days we'll look back and it will be one of those telltale stories and you know, of this, the young sort of, you know, cyber criminal and then how they got caught and undone as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty big operation. The FBI got 50 million unique credentials out of it. So you know, when they sort of looked at it. So, you know, he's young, he's 26. He's clearly making a lot of money if he's driving a Porsche Cayenne and posting gangster photos. But those creds belong to somebody, right? So, you know, there is also that human side of things. We've just talked about Optus and Medibank. And on the other side of all that money is a bunch of people who are probably going to have to deal with, you know, more difficult lives and identity theft because of that stuff. So, not good.
Yeah. And when I first saw this, I immediately thought to that other young fellow up in Brisbane who wrote that spyware and started selling that across and made, you know, 400, 500 grand, whatever it is. So it's a lot of money in it, but you're absolutely right, Carl. Like at the end of it, there's going to be someone who has to pay for it. And it's going to be someone who unknowingly has given up their information. They don't know it's actually been leaked or out there. So.
And Dan, if they make the movie, I want it to be after the Anom movie. Like they need to make that one about the app first that the AFP and the FBI put out. That is going to be an incredible movie when it gets made.
Indeed. We're staying in Europe for our final deep dive story this week, which is an attack on Europe's largest copper smelter, operations called Aurubis. Gar, what can you tell us about what's happened with this large-scale infrastructure attack and its potential implications for us locally?
Yeah, I mean, look, this caught my eye based on what was kind of reported in a ransomware analysis by Dragos on, you know, kind of metal and mining, you know, apparently a broad scale campaign that was hitting those verticals or those industries. And yeah, this organization called Aurubis, who are a copper smelter, were hit. And as part of that, their procurement and raw material systems were taken down. So, you know, obviously that's not good. And they had to put in place kind of manual systems to be able to kind of work around that. It raises an important point around sort of cyber resilience. And, you know, we talk about this a lot, is that if digital systems fail, sometimes physical systems are a perfectly acceptable backup, at least temporarily. You know, the hotel example is the one that comes up all the time, where if your little card, you know, if you've put that card beside your phone and it doesn't work anymore, which is nearly all of the time, if you have a physical key, well, does the same job, right? You know, lets you in the door and it's kind of relatively secure. In this case, Aurubis were able to kind of fall back on manual processes. So we're able to kind of, you know, maintain operations, but, you know, they weren't in a position to know when those procurement and raw material systems were going to be back up. So, you know, the question mark over that. I think it gets interesting just given the stresses and the brittleness of supply chain in general, which COVID made very clear to the world, you know, how incredibly on the verge all of this stuff is of, it feels like, collapse. You know, we nearly ran out of toilet paper because I think Vin bought all of it when COVID hit. but, you know, it does really show how you see an impact like this. And yeah, oh, it's copper, but copper is used for so many things. And if this is the largest smelter and we're already in supply chain stress, is there a lag effect here where, not right now, but in a couple of months or 6 months, do we see that, you know, start to show up somewhere else in, you know, the products and the things that are made from copper? And then I started thinking, well, actually think about Australia, where mining is a huge part of our local GDP, mining and resources. You know, I think it could be up to 10% in some years. Like, it's a huge, huge part of our sort of economic stability. And what led us through the GRC back in 2007, 2008 was resources and what that meant to us. And then thinking a little bit further on that, how so much of mining these days is automated, right? You know, the where it used to be guys in hard hats jumping in these big trucks and kind of driving them down those kind of loopy roads that could end into the mine. Like, that's all, it's all machines now. It's all GPS tracked, a little bit like farming machinery, you know, where you don't really need the humans to do it. Cool, that's great. You know, you cut the expenses, and there's probably OH&S benefits there too, where people aren't at risk in a dangerous industry. But that OT then is vulnerable to attack and starts to become, you know, much more susceptible to cyber attacks, which is pretty obvious. So yeah, I think Australia as a country, and WA particularly, is going to be impacted by this, given it's, you know, massively weighted towards mining for their economy. And it's on their radar. I actually started kind of going down the rabbit hole on this one. And they've got a conference coming up, and cyber is like front and center in terms of the conversation. PwC have done a sort of, you know, a kind of audit and report, and we're going to be part of that for the mining industry. So I think they are aware of the risk given how their industry has changed. And then I think there was, from the reading I did, there was maybe a perception that they're lagging a little bit in terms of really understanding what that risk is and sort of protecting those OT and IT systems as well for, you know, clearly a very critical industry for Australia.
So just thinking about this and linking it back to the first story that we discussed with like those high profile breaches at the moment, is Australia being targeted? Is there something specific and you know, that is coming after us and now is resourcing, you know, the next frontier, given that they've had some success in Europe? Does that become a target vector for Australia? Have we got a big target on our back for some reason?
I think we do, but I think we always had. I don't think there's a campaign happening at the moment. I mean, I don't know, but if I had to guess at the moment, I would say no. I think what we're seeing is just a bunch of stuff that was probably going to happen eventually happen at the same time. And it feels like a campaign because there's kind of compression in the timelines, and especially with Optus and Medibank so close together. I mean, those two are huge. I mean, Optus was the biggest ever. And then Medibank felt like the biggest ever because of what was breached. And I'm not laughing like, ha-ha, but I'm laughing because probably a little bit of sort of nervousness about it all. I don't think so. If I had a guess, I would say no. I think we're seeing it more. We're probably maybe reporting it more. It's much more public and much more talked about. And it's part of the zeitgeist as well. You know, we're since our PM came out and sort of said we're under sustained attack, I think people are just thinking about it more. So it's actually mainstream media before. Whereas before, maybe it wouldn't. Well, Optus always would have been, and so would Medibank. But a lot of this stuff is starting to get attention and interest. I'm seeing it show up at the barbecue conversations and, you know, in social circles where no one really cared before. All of a sudden, you know, I don't know about you guys, when with my wife and we're introduced to parties, I would always say, oh, I work in IT because, you know, it was a dead end conversation. People weren't that interested. But now it's like, oh, cyber. Oh, and people have an opinion and they want to have a conversation. So it feels like a bit of that going on to me.
Yeah, that's definitely happened around my, I guess, the circle that I hang around with as well. And, you know, I'm very similar to you, Gar, where people will say, oh, what do you do? And you say, IT, and they default to, well, you must work with computers then. Like, can you help me with my computer? And she's like, no, not really, but I can give it a crack. People just asking questions. Like, I had someone who was in their probably 50s asking, hey, Vin, you know, I'm currently using this antivirus. Is that a good one? Like, if you talked about this 10 years ago, there's no way they would have known like what was already on their machine or what antivirus they're using. They could actually buy more protection on top of that. It's the right question. It's getting that kind of visibility over cyber and getting everyone to kind of think of cyber in the day-to-day. And we're seeing a movement, I guess, to make that a lot more common.
And then maybe the answer, Dan, is we are, but no more than usual. Like, that's the other perspective. You know, we're like, it's not a campaign. It's just an ongoing campaign that's in the background all the time. We've talked about this in the pod before, that, you know, that idea that cyber warfare is kind of the new normal, and it's been going on for a really long time. Like, it's not a new thing, and cyber attacks are not a new thing. So I don't know if it's a campaign so much as just it's business as usual. It just happened to be that two big breaches happened very close together.
And I really see the two of you hating the fact of being centre of attention at the barbecues and espousing your cyber wisdom. I'm sure that's a burden that I'm sure you're able to bear.
I just tell them to listen to the pod, Dan. I say, I'm like, I'm not getting into this now. Here's the link. Go listen.
Go listen here. Exactly. So finally, let's wrap up with a quick review of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. The first news item is the deepfake of Joe Biden singing Baby Shark.
Oh, how good is this one? It's a sort of a throwaway, but it's actually kind of important at the same time. So there was nothing nefarious here. It wasn't, you know, I don't think there was any political agenda. It sounded like somebody was just having a laugh and made a funny video of Joe Biden saying that he was going to do the national anthem and then breaking into Baby Shark, which I think people secretly love, by the way. I know there's a huge backlash against Baby Shark. But I personally think it's an awesome song. So great to see Joe Biden supporting it, obviously through a deep fake. So, okay, so like, haha, it's sort of funny. You know, we'll have a bit of a joke about it. But when you think about certainly the political climate in the US and the accusations of, you know, age and what that means to be a president and, you know, Sleepy Joe and all the stuff that's kind of was going on in the run-up to the election and still continues, and how divided that country is. People are kind of looking for evidence for their beliefs. That's an age-old thing. You know, it's nothing new there. But the problem is people see something like this, and, you know, apparently some people have latched on and sort of said, oh, he's, you know, it's dementia, not kind of acknowledging that it's a deep fake and it's a joke, but actually that the president of the United States, you know, in a moment of dementia, basically sang Baby Shark by accident. I mean, it's ridiculous when you say those words out loud, but we live in a ridiculous world. This is kind of scary. In the same week, by the way, I saw a video, and I think Vin was on the same WhatsApp group, where somebody sent a video around of the movie Titanic, and the scene where the lady comes in to get her picture painted and, you know, paint me like one of your French ladies, blah, blah, like that scene in Titanic. But they deep faked Arnold Schwarzenegger on there, and it was really like, it was a weird couple of minutes, but it was sort of, it was funny. And, you know, you could tell it was a deep fake, but it wasn't a bad job, and weirdly had the mannerisms of the actress. You know, everything was kind of there. And like, that's the worry. And, you know, we've talked about this in the pod before. The bit where it starts to become really convincing and there's a political announcement, you know, Zelensky gets up and says, hey, we're actually surrendering. You know, if you're Ukraine military, like, just give it up. We're done. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure they've got things in place to make so that, you know, appearing on Twitter and saying that isn't going to have that effect. But you get the idea that you could start to influence things in a pretty significant way once these things get convincing enough.
Indeed. And exactly that. It's not so much the Baby Shark incident, but it's the use of deep fake, right? And how far can that go? And then how realistic does it become? And its implications far more broadly. Next is the latest vulnerability fixes released by OpenSSL. Finn, this is an important update based on our previous discussions regarding open source libraries.
Definitely. And, you know, when you think open source, it wasn't that long ago when we were talking about Log4j, right? Open source and how, and I'd be interesting to run through, if we did an audit of all the code bases out there, like how the percentage of these code bases that leverage open source components as part of it, because it definitely is helpful, right? It saves time for development teams. Instead of writing your own stuff, if you've got something out there that already works, why not incorporate that into what you're writing up in your application? But in this case, it's more of a public service announcement. What was originally a critical status in terms of risk for a vulnerability has now been downgraded to a higher, but still the intent here is to make sure you patch, right? If you're running OpenSSL 3.0.0, to make sure you have the most recent update that covers this particular vulnerability.
No, thank you. Definitely a good public service announcement there, and making sure that we always are getting those latest fixes and patches in place. Finally, there's been an update from the Kaspersky researchers. What are they telling us?
So this is a load info. It's been around for a little while, but certainly kind of looks like it's kind of, there's been a bit of a resurgence, and they're being tracked as APT-10, Chinese-speaking threat actor. But looking like they have sort of added to their ways of infection vectors and finding ways to do it filelessly. So there's a sort of download or shellcode that goes directly into the winward.exe. So yeah, one to kind of watch out for, I suppose. It's been, like I said, it's been around for a while. It's not new. It's been tracked for quite some time, but yeah, definitely one to pay attention to.
Very good. Well, thank you, Gar and Vin. Appreciate your insights in another big news episode today. Until next week, if you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump onto getcyberresilient.com and check out some of the latest articles, including a full wrap of the news from October in our This Month in Security article. Also, a look at how to plug the identity gaps in cloud security with Yes, IAM. And we look forward to how a recession could hit your cyber defenses. So thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.